This is Glenn Thrush. I'm joined today by David Axelrod, former senior advisor to President Obama, and by his own description, the official keeper of the message for Obama's two presidential victories. David's new book, Believer, is just out, and it's an account not only of Obama's eventful presidency and his political travails, but of Axelrod's own 40-year journey as a reporter, columnist, Chicago political operative, father, son, and turkey leg munching patron of Manny's Deli, where he has been honored, and I know this because I saw this with my own two eyes, with his own two-top table complete with a brass plaque.
Yes.
David, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Now, one of the things I've heard you say a lot, and you've said it a lot to me, was that you didn't just want to write another Washington Reed biography.
Yes.
Right, that would occupy a news cycle and create a firestorm.
Right.
And indeed, much if not most of this book is about your non-Obama life.
Right.
So, of course, I'm going to start off by going in exactly the opposite direction.
Well, I'm realistic about these are the hailstorms one has to navigate through to get to the other side.
I'm glad to hear that you're braced. Let me start off with a little bit of controversy. In Believer, you write that President Obama willfully kept his support of gay marriage private at your urging to avoid the political fallout from black preachers and others. In an interview with BuzzFeed yesterday, the president said you were, quote, mixing up my personal feelings with my position on the issue. What's the story? Which one of you is right?
Well, I don't see much of a conflict between the two. The fact is that he felt that gay, lesbian couples should have equal rights. He understood there was great resistance in the in some quarters, and in the African American church, in the communities that he served, it was very strong. He tried to address that through the vehicle of civil unions, but he was frustrated by it, and he acknowledged in that interview with BuzzFeed that he was frustrated by it, and ultimately he said that he was going to, if he got asked the question about how he would vote as a state legislator in Illinois where they were considering gay marriage, he would say that he was going to vote for it. He told us that in the fall of 2011, and he said, I'm going to answer it that way. There were people in our councils who were worried about some of the battleground states, but he said, he was going to speak out on it, and we ought to be prepared for it. So when he says he evolved on the issue, I think that's exactly what he did.
One of the things I've heard sort of through the grapevine, and I know you love being asked these kinds of questions, is that, you know, the president and some of the people around him in the White House are a little bit annoyed by this. Have you heard any feedback from anybody?
No. Well, I saw what the president said. I saw his transcript. But I don't think they should be annoyed. I think this is as much a parable about how these things get covered as the substance itself. Because if you look at what the president said and what I said, they're really not that different. The fact is that the president acknowledged that he had frustrations with the gulf between his feelings and his personal views and the position that he took publicly. And that's really what I was saying.
Well, in 2007, I remember when I was at Newsday, I don't know if you recall, General Peter Pace of the Joint Chiefs called homosexuality immoral. And Hillary was asked about it by Stephanopoulos on ABC, and I caught up with Obama, I think, at the firefighters' convention here in D.C., and he refused to answer three questions that I had about it, and then I think there was a little bit of a firestorm, and both him and Hillary put out statements sort of saying that they disputed what Pace had to say. But isn't that sort of a perfect example of the kind of issue that the kind of issue that's so difficult for a politician like him to deal with? I mean, here's a guy whose stock and trade, and it's yours, is integrity, but a lot of politics is artifice, right?
Well, I mean, when you look at the guy's record and when you look what he's accomplished in this area, I think you see that here was somebody who was looking for a way forward, trying to navigate through the politics, but with a clear point of view. And he turned out to be the president who ended the Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. He was the president who withdrew the administration's support for DOMA, which led expedited the end of DOMA. He and ultimately his support for gay marriage was a factor in gay marriage in the gay marriage movement accelerating. And I think if you talk to gay activists, they'd acknowledge that no president has done as much as he's done. So I never doubted where his heart was, and that's reflected in the book. And it ultimately was also reflected in the actions he took as president. And Glenna, you're a student of history. History is replete with cases of some of our great leaders finding a way through the minefield of politics to get the country to where they felt the country should go. And he's in that tradition.
Just in terms of, you know, nobody's been more loyal and on message. I was really amused by an interview you did with NPR where the interviewer said, when you went into the White House, you went on the Sunday show, it was like, what the hell happened to Axe? Yeah. This is not the same guy. For a book like this, and this had to be a really tricky exercise for you, did you talk with folks in the White House? Did you kind of let them know what was coming?
The only chapters that were reviewed by the White House were the ones on national security, because I think, we all had certain restrictions in exchange for having clear national security clearance. I wanted to make sure that I wasn't unwittingly tripping over any of those, and so I asked them to review that. But no one in the White House saw the book before it was printed and bound, including the president.
Has he seen it?
He has seen it.
Have you gotten any feedback from him on it?
You know, his feedback has been supportive, encouraging, positive. He, as with anything, he had a few things that he probably prefer I didn't have in there, and we'll like, leave that between us. But
just one, come on.
he did raise one point that I think was very legitimate, and that is that. Before the first debate, and I wrote extensively about that, I did, and so others in the room did advise him not to engage too much with Romney, in part because in the prep sessions we had where John Kerry was playing Romney, the president was so nasty in the exchanges that we thought, well, boy, we don't want to see this churlish character on the debate stage. And so we opted to tell him, don't get in those kind of clinches. He may have learned that lesson a little too well.
One of the things I find really interesting about this is your candor in really talking about kind of the fault line between bullshit and integrity, like exactly what we were talking about before. And you quote him as saying, "I'm not really good at bullshitting." I mean, that really is a fault line that guys like you live on, right?
I guess. Ultimately, I think that you have to build campaigns around what is real, what is true, what the essence of someone is, what the essence of what they care about is, especially a campaign for president. You know, I've said before that these are like MRIs for the soul, and whoever you are, people find out. So you've got to build campaigns around who someone really is. And I think that Obama is as authentic a person as I know in public life. So it was easy in his case. But that's always a tug and pull in politics, because it's easy to look at polls and understand what people want you to say. The hard thing in both running and governing is doing what you know to be right. And he's done that. Look, he's defied polling so many times that I think he's certified himself as someone who's willing to take on that kind of pressure. I always joke about the fact that I was the one who went to him with the polling about the auto bailout, and went to him the polling on health care, and all of which argued against him taking the positions that he took, and he dismissed it because he felt they were the right things to do. So I joke that I like him so much because he listened to me so little.
Well, one of the things you're just talking about, authenticity and sort of a candidate who knows who he or she is. I think one of the really interesting dynamics that's going on right now with Hillary Clinton is how that question will be answered. And I co-authored a piece with my former colleague Maggie Haberman here a couple of months ago detailing how David Plouffe, the other David, kind of briefed Clinton and her staff over in Whitehaven and said two things. First of all, start the campaign a little earlier so that you don't get too defined. But also, figure out what your message is and stick to it rigorously, which is what you guys did so well in 2008.
Right.
What do you think so far? Do you think she is
I don't think that that question can be answered yet, because I don't really believe she's been a candidate. This is sort of the peculiar position she's found herself in, because she was a presumed candidate. She was out around the book. She was out making speeches. But she really hadn't she wasn't a candidate. She hadn't done the work around.
Was that a good idea? I mean, to do. I mean, we're still talking about six-figure paid speeches. I'm old enough to remember her listening tour. You were around for that as well.
I was, yeah.
Should she be doing something a little bit different than this?
Well, we'll see what she does when she actually becomes a candidate. Look, if I had been advising her, would I have advised that route? No, but I can't speak to, you know, I mean, she had some opportunities she wanted to seize, and she did that. But that's the fact is that her campaign is being formulated now. Everything I see suggests that she's doing a good deal of soul searching and a good deal of giving a good deal of thought to both the structure of the campaign and the rationale for the campaign. Why she feels she should run for president, and she's answering that question for herself. And she, you know,
what do you think that rationale is? Personally,
I honestly believe, you know, I know her pretty well. I've worked for her and I've worked against her, and I've known her for 20 years. I think she believes deeply in this country, the principle that people in this country, the broadest number of people should get the fairest shot, and people who work hard should get ahead, and you know, you shouldn't be limited by the circumstances in which you're born. All the things that unite a lot of us around a set of principles. She's a very, you know, serious person about public policy and public life. She believes in public service.
And she was very good in those after sort of the Super Tuesday period in 2008.
Well, I've said that. You know, yeah. You were there. You covered it. I think she was a bad candidate in 2007. Really kind of debilitated by the presumption of inevitability that rendered her very cautious. Well, when she lost in Iowa and the race seemed almost lost, she threw that caution to the wind. And what we saw as a campaign running against her was someone who was much more visceral, much more connecting. The advocacy was there. Her own vulnerabilities were more Absolutely. Obvious and made her more approachable. And so the question really for her moving forward is, can she reclaim that authentic self, and or does she, you know, how does she handle the presumption of inevitability,
particularly
now?
After and at that point in time she had been in the Senate and she was doing a fair amount of retail politicking. She had spent 4 years in state in gilded rooms, and now she spent a couple of years sort of not necessarily mixing with regular people. Do you think, you know, the candidate that you worked for in 2008 was a guy who had just paid off his student loans? How do you get a candidate who's basically been 6 years away from the grassroots to really get back connected?
Yeah, well, I think that part will come back, you know, being out of campaigning. I think that will come back. I don't know, you know, that her circumstances now render her. I guess I question whether her circumstances now somehow render her unable to empathize with the struggles of people. What was clear when she ran in 2008, as opposed to 2007, right. is she was drawing on her own experience growing up in a middle class family, and the struggles they had. And you know, I suspect that she's focusing on that experience now, and she's going to need to draw on that in order to be the candidate she needs to be.
Well, I want to read you do you the great disservice of reading you your own words. In 2007, you reprinted this memo. This was a memo you wrote for then-Senator Obama. You said of Clinton, for all of her advantages, she is not a healing figure. After two decades of the Bush-Clinton saga, making herself the candidate of the future will be a challenge.
Right.
Apparently, we have another Bush that's bouncing around now. isn't that to some extent still true?
Well, I think the times are different, Glenn. I think that was an entirely different period. She had voted for the war in Iraq, which was the defining issue in the Democratic Party and in much of the electorate. Senator Obama hadn't supported the war in Iraq. That was a big dividing line between them. She had been in Washington in the Senate a little bit longer, and then the Clinton years before that in the White House. So she had been right in the thick of the political wars for a long time. We're in a different place now. She's been removed from that. The country's in a different place now. And I've always said, and I wrote in this book, that the outgoing incumbent defines the election, and people never want the replica of what they have. They want the remedy. And I don't mean they had a Democrat, so they want a Republican. I mean, this goes to personal qualities. They wanted Barack Obama in 2008 in part because George Bush was a guy who had a Manichaean view of the world, everything black and white, didn't see the gray, didn't see the nuance. And they wanted someone who did, and they got him in Barack Obama. I think the pendulum will swing back a little in 2016. They'll want someone who's a little less nuanced, a little more direct in their approach. And Hillary Clinton, I think, is better suited for that race. I think they also are going to want, rather than someone who will challenge the system in Washington, they want someone who's going to be able to navigate the system in Washington and try and get things done after these
years. In part because
years.
Of the difficulty that the president has had?
Yes. And I think that she is well-positioned to be that candidate.
One of the things I find really endearing about this book is how honest you are about your own ambivalence about power in Washington. I mean, you have talked, and I've heard you say this a million times, particularly out on the trail in 08, how much you hated Washington, and you always talk about sort of Washington thinking. But you also say that it's really addictive. And and when you left, you said how bummed you are that Obama didn't answer your emails quite as quickly. And you were really honestly hurt when he called you, I think I can use the word, we could bleep it out, when he called you a motherfucker during debate prep. You really do have an ambivalence about D.C.,
well,
right?
Well, first of all, let's separate out the issues and deal with the easier one first.
Yeah.
I wasn't that offended when he said that because it was the night before the first debate, and I told him that I didn't think he had done very well in the last prep, and he was unhappy that I said that. But he really was unhappy because he knew that he wasn't ready for that
And
debate.
He fessed up to it.
Yeah, and I knew that. That wasn't a problem. In terms of Washington, here's my feeling about Washington. I feel about Washington the way my mother used to say she felt about me. She said, I love you. It's just the things you do I hate.
I'm sorry, David. That's a part of the Jewish mother's playbook. I've heard that before.
I think there's so much, the institutions of Washington are, you know, since I was a small child, they mean something to me. I think important things happen here. I work at the University of Chicago now. I run an institute of politics. The whole purpose is to persuade young people that there is meaning in all of this and that I always tell them Congress is going to meet with them or without them. I mean, I am, as someone who's been steeped in this all my life, I loved being around that. What I didn't love was the pathology of the town, this who's up and who's down pathology of the town, this, you know, complete fascination with stuff that is only interesting to people in Washington. I said being in the White House was like working in a submarine and looking at the world through a periscope. Those are the things that I didn't like. Gary Hart once told me, and I wrote this in the book, the former senator, that Washington's always the last to get the news. I think that's true.
That's not wrong. Yeah, I've likened covering the White House, by the way. I'm glad you had a periscope. I didn't.
Yeah.
To covering a horse race from inside a horse.
Yeah.
You just really, sometimes the close-up view is not the best view. About the press, the president's really ambivalent about the press. He's a passionate New York Times reader. I think I've picked that up from your book and elsewhere. Were you positively or negatively were you surprised at all by the kind of coverage? Do you feel less or more cynical about the whole thing?
It sounds like a line, but some of my best friends are reporters because I grew up as a reporter. I believe in journalism, and I love good journalism. And I like reporters who tend to be funny and smart and incisive. But I think a lot has happened to the news media over the years since I began that has made the ability to have perspective much more difficult. The immediacy of the Twitter, you know, social media generation, the proliferation of outlets, some.
But don't you think that's swinging back a little bit? We're getting, like, for instance, you know, we were the poster the child for the irresponsible barn burners, right? And we now have, for instance, a magazine. We've been doing more long form stuff. Don't you think it's
moving back a little bit? No, but let me give you an example.
Yeah.
And this happens regularly, but this is the most glaring of recent times. The Ebola outbreak. and everybody in this town went nuts. The nightly news is, newscasts were, you know, 4, 5, 7 minutes of, you know, the scourge that threatens all of America. Public health people said no.
Right.
And yet, you know, it hijacked, essentially hijacked a lot of news coverage for weeks and weeks and weeks until it disappeared as a story. And my experience here has been that happens an awful lot. There, every day is election day in Washington, and at least a dozen times a year you confront the defining issue of your presidency. Almost never, that almost never turned out to be the defining issue of your presidency. And I think that's because of competitive pressures and the nature of modern communications that, you know, someone tweets something, someone says something, someone tweets it, everybody reacts. I think that there's less time for perspective, at least in, you know, a lot of the daily coverage. It's just a kind of mindless exercise sometimes. So I get frustrated with that. Lack of context and perspective.
Well, to prove...
I like your magazine, though. I do like your magazine.
Thank you. Susan Glasser is...
you guys have done great with that.
As an outsider who has often tried to pry my way inside, as you are well aware...
Yes.
You've hung up the phone several times on me. I have to say some of the stuff I personally love are the snapshots of the inside players, you know. None of these are huge surprises, but it's nice to see what the wallpaper really looked like. And I have to say, especially the portrait of Valerie Jarrett, and you had some ambivalence about Valerie on this. I got to throw something at you. Recently, I was interviewing a senior member of the House Republican leadership, and they said to me, does Valerie Jarrett really run the country? Why, A, do you think that's true? And B, why do you think that perception is out there?
I don't know why that perception is out there. My feeling is that Valerie is a very close friend of the president. She's someone he trusts, but the notion that she's running the country or that she's the principal policymaker in the White House is just a fallacy. It's not true.
Why do you think it's so persistent, though?
It's
not my perception, right? I mean, you must hear it too, right?
You know, I can just tell you what the reality is. Yeah. The reality is the president is very much in control of his own operation. There are plenty of people around him on policy who are deeply, deeply enmeshed in the decision making he makes. She's got her portfolios, and she speaks to him about those portfolios. But this notion that she is embedded in everything is just not true.
One other person I wanted to ask you about, Elizabeth Warren. You have a very interesting. Yeah. Set of you were one of the people, I guess, and Valerie was too, who sort of ushered her in. And she, here's something I didn't know: she lived in your building.
Yeah, we were neighbors. Yeah.
Did you ever meet at the trash compactor or doing your laundry?
In the gym, sometimes we would see each other. I'd see her. She had a dog since passed away, a big golden retriever named Otis, great dog. So we saw a lot of each other in those in that period of time.
One of the anecdotes that you tell in this is the president telling her to kind of hush up. When news...
Well, you know, first of all, Elizabeth was the inspiration behind the Consumer Finance Protection Agency. It's something that she'd been proposing for years. You know, she really had bona fides as a great advocate for working people around these financial issues. And she really wanted to run the agency.
Known. She was somebody who was a Harvard professor, came from the outside. Seemed like she had an awful lot figured out coming in. Right?
Well, look, she was a Harvard professor, but she was also a young single mother without a law degree to start. And she fought her way to the position that she was in, and she reflects that toughness. Elizabeth is as tough as anybody I know.
Okay, so the final question. Speaking of toughness, I think a lot of the people who know you best are most struck by the personal stuff in here, particularly the discussion of your parents.
Mm-hmm.
And it sounded like you had a complicated childhood. You talk
yes.
about your father's suicide with a lot of candor. The image that really strikes me is you listening, I guess it was Melissa, the Allman Brothers
yeah,
song.
Jessica, yeah.
Jessica, I'm sorry, yeah. When the cops came in and told
yeah.
you about it.
Yeah.
And you also talk about your mother, a really interesting, driven figure. How tough was it for you to to write about that stuff candidly.
It was hard. It was hard. I had written about my father once before, but only after 30 years. And the reason I wrote about him was because I began to realize that I didn't talk about it ever, and I didn't talk about it because I thought that there was something to be ashamed of, ashamed for him, of him, because he committed suicide. And I realized that was wrong. And it was probably the same impulse that caused him not to go and get help when he needed help. And I knew there were a lot of other people in that same predicament, and that if I started talking about these things, perhaps others would feel more free to talk about them. Plus, if you're writing an autobiography, that was such an important event in my life that it would have been a dishonest book not to write about it. The relationship with my mother was, who was a former journalist and
PM
pioneer
magazine.
In qualitative research, very driven person, very complicated person. But it was a central relationship in my life. It took me a long time to sort those issues out when I was writing the book, and she passed away before I finished the book.
Obviously, you're a hybrid of these two people, but who do you think, who do you think you're more like?
Well, I don't think that I would be sitting here without my mother's drive and perhaps some of the, whether it's genetic or taught, some of the skills, the ability to write, I learned a lot about research from her and so on. So I have that, all of that. I'd like to hope that I have some of my dad's humanity. He was a very gentle, loving
soul. A mensch,
soul,
he seemed like.
A total mensch. Yeah. And I miss him every day. I try and live my life in a way that would honor his character. And so it's... writing a book is difficult in that way, because if you're going to write an honest book, you have to dredge up a lot of feelings that that are hard to confront.
Well, David Axelrod, author of Believer, thanks so much for stopping by.
Thank you for having me, Glenn.
Okay. Really, thank you so much.
Thank you. I mean.